Hey, welcome back. Rhetoric Warriors podcast. It's Friday here at the beach in California, and we're going to do some of the stuff. This is sophisticated persuasion training for a complicated modern world. And it's also what I think we're going to do today is an episode of what I call The Blast, which is where we pick up current events and we sort of filter them through rhetoricians and comedians and academics and anybody who has a perspective, just to keep it interesting. I'm Dr. Dan, rhetorician, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors and the podcast. Here I talk to comedians about their careers in politics. I convert conservatives because the right needs it. Get back to democracy. It's not that bad, trust me. And I talk to persuasion pros and rhetoricians. Podcast has more rhetoricians than any other podcast you're going to hear today. So this is The Blast. Fun, but having a... I prefer to think this as stomping the cultural minefield in clown shoes. Yeah. My guest today...
Why is that so violent, Dan? It's so violent.
We'll get to your nonviolent communication stuff. Take it easy there, guru. My guest is a really interesting blend. Really interesting guy. He has a rhetoric MA. He worked for a high-powered university think tank-ish, whatever they called it. He now works in business, but he can't keep himself out of all sorts of other nests. He works in nonviolent communication. I'm perfectly happy to talk about that concept. Yoga, entrepreneurialism, wants to do some comedy, ketamine, you name it, he's doing it. Jonathan Ooh, Alba.
Yeah. Have you experienced, well, ketamine legally or illegally, Dan?
Is that the trigger one? Like ketamine jumped up and he's like, I'll talk about that one.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible. It's powerful.
Well, it's a drug. Of course it is. That's how people like drugs.
It's also medicine.
Of course it is.
Also medicine. Yes.
Sure it is. I'm sure it's medicine. Like, it's really good to label things medicine and drugs these days. Like, you know, that's how marijuana snuck in.
Plant-based medicine. Yes.
Yes. And mushrooms are sneaking in that way. Psilocybins or whatever how do you say that word?
Psilocybin, I believe, would be the term you're looking for.
That's it.
Yeah.
You're the ketamine guy. You would know all the different options. Ayahuasca.
Haven't done that, but yes, heard.
If I hear one more Californian say they're on ayahuasca or talk about their trip, I'm going to just start smacking people.
Well, ketamine was, I recently just did ketamine therapy at a retreat. It's really powerful. I've never done anything like that in my life. And my gosh.
Snapped the neurons, did it?
Kind yeah.
Just everything through the rinse cycle.
Beautiful state of neuroplasticity and just got so much great perspective on my life. So I'm pro ketamine therapy.
Yeah. It's tricky, right? Though it's tricky because you know it's a drug. And drugs create elation. They create, you know, all these different things artificially. But then on the other hand, you're putting food and everything in your body all the time, which are also affecting mood and all these things. So why are drugs so different? It's positive, negative. It's a seesaw.
Yeah. You know, like when I came out of my journey, which is what they were called.
Sure. Why not call it a journey?
It was a journey. I went to a very far off place. And I woke up.
Were you dragged through this journey or were you led? Were you guided?
I was flying through my journey. Okay. So I was guided and flying. And when I came out of it, that was like one of the first thoughts of like, I felt so positive and so much warmth and love and compassion for myself and a lot of people in my life. And then I was like, wait a minute, I just took a drug. So there was that cognitive dissonance that I was dealing with.
I remember there's lots of constructed experiences that get people into that sort of nirvana state. I went to an all-male Catholic high school and they always did a retreat. And God knows what actually happened on, you know, it's all-male, you know, priest and everything on the retreat. But the guys would always come back very, you know, together. Like I never went, but they would always be like, you could feel it for a couple of days. They'd been kind of guru'd and emotioned and they bonded and then it went away 3 days.
So imagine that feeling lasting for months. Cause I mean, I still feel it today. Like I can, you know, when I meditate, I can close my eyes and picture bits of that journey. And then I just have like a newfound awareness. So yeah, imagine that lasting for many weeks or months. And I'm not, you know, sure how long the benefits last. So they studied the crap out of it, or researched the crap out of it. So I'm grateful
but
for
as
it.
As a rhetorician, going back to your rhetorician.
Now, here it comes. Here right? it comes.
Yeah. How does your rhetorician consciousness not dissect, or, you know, sort of deal in a different way with that sort of elevated ketamine experience? Because, you know, there are endless amounts of guru camps, endless amounts of treatments, endless amounts of goods. But as a rhetorician, you're always listening to this stuff, you know, putting it through the wood chipper.
Yeah, it was it's really difficult to be a rhetorician on that journey, as well as, you know, working in the world of events, because there was some of the execution of that was a little off kilter. Some of the teachings, you know, or workshops that were led, it was like, what's going on here? So for me, it was like taking what was beautiful and just discarding the rest, and doing my best to do that, because it was such a gift. So I'm as a rhetorician, I'm choosing to focus on the positive versus all the negative, so to speak. And I guess what was fascinating to me is I signed up and went without knowing anything about ketamine. This is kind of a theme. Like, I'm doing yoga teacher training right now, and I signed up not knowing what to expect, or, you know, what's going on. So anyway,
also a cult, by the way, yoga.
I'm happy to join the yoga cult. There are far worse.
I'm not saying they're bad. They're just cults.
This yoga teacher training, by the way, Dan, is it's a mix of tantric Buddhism with hatha yoga. So it's perfect follow-up for post ketamine journey. The ketamine thing, though, like, after I got out of the retreat, that's when I started to learn about the science and the research that's been conducted around it. And it's really fascinating.
So you start to shape the experience rhetorically by taking in science and knowledge about it.
Yeah. So I can feel better about myself.
Sure. Yeah. And all that stuff is, you know, again, I try not to, when I tell people about rhetoric and try to bring them into the rhetoric cult, I try not to, you know, just hold on to the cynicism or the dissectedness of it. Like, you know, a rhetorician dissects everything. You can't believe in something wholeheartedly as a rhetorician. Because, you know, it's a constructed experience. It may be positively constructed and well constructed and good for the world, or it may be somewhere in the middle, or maybe horrible. You just don't know until you kind of take it apart and start judging it.
So how would you market ketamine as a rhetorician?
Like, as a full-on believer?
Yeah.
Like the wide-eyed, you know, magical sparkle in their eyes like you have about ketamine?
Yes. Like, one of my favorite jobs, I think, would have been to, well, I don't know, maybe it'll be in the future, to like advertise marijuana, to create marketing material for marijuana companies. I'm just curious now, if like ketamine becomes a thing and there's clinics, you know, spreading all over the United States, they're going to have to, you know, use rhetoric.
For sure.
To recruit, dealing with regulatory issues. Yeah, I'm curious, in the mind of a rhetorician, how would you approach that?
Well, what I would do is step back and use the book that you haven't read because I made you buy it, which basically is a operating manual for designing persuasion across the board. So 21 Colosseums. There's a menu of 21 huge mega options you can use to create your rhetoric. So mythologies, mythos, story would definitely be part of it, because this is what people do, even with ayahuasca. They always tie it back to its mythological roots. Oh, this came from a tribe in Peru and the shaman and then, and that gives it a legitimacy because people like that story, you know, and they're like, oh, the old ways. They knew, you know, they knew something. And so that's one way of going at it. It's like, well, let's look at the story construction for this. And I don't know, ketamine has no tribal origins, does it?
No, I'm pretty sure it's created in a lab. I mean, it's been used as an anesthetic and a sedative for many, many years.
So that would probably be like, if we're going to do mythos with ketamine, you'd probably go back to LSD, right? Timothy Leary, the 60s, it has a mythology to it, you know, and microdosing, you know, with LSD, and then the government coming in and hating the fact that people found something that could make them happy. So I would literally, I just use that stuff as like software. Like, okay, if we really want to do great rhetoric, we need all 21 of these things firing, you know? And like going back into the science, like you're doing is logos. So it's going into the hyper rationality of this to get some legitimacy and defend people off from their, you know, how dare you give me a drugness? Because drugs have been so villainized. So, you know, who knows?
Yeah, I mean, the fascinating thing for me was the folks that were on this journey with me were, I think 5 out of 6 were all healthcare professionals, which was incredible. I think there's a new wave coming with psychedelics or whatever, however you want to label. I think ketamine's a narcotic. But that was what was telling, again, to me as someone who knew very little about ketamine. So, that's a really good point, though, with the logos. That's exactly what I was doing. Is like, I need to be able to defend this to people when I'm talking to folks like you and other folks. John, what the hell did you do?
Right, you do. And like the other thing you need to be aware of, and I did this, I tried to get this going with paleo community back when paleo was so popular before keto kind of took over as the de facto alternate health eating structure, was you need to set it up politically, because what's going to happen to this is, you know, the people who do negative politics, whether it's the right or the left, typically it's the right. The right typically, you know, uses negative politics much more powerfully and much more commonly. They're gonna go after this too. They go after any drug, and there's a whole history of ways to stain, you know, and destroy you for taking drugs. And so you probably need to prepare for that politically too, because the ketamine industry, every industry comes up and like, oh, we found something great, we just have to offer it to people, and then it gets yanked over into politics and destroyed because they're not prepared rhetorically to defend it.
And I'm not sure people are prepared for like mass ketamine use. Like, I'm not sure that would be a positive. And I've had to learn about, you know, the addictive side of it, and it
can be prescribed in the water supply, like fluoride.
It could be prescribed as like an inhaler in a sense, where it goes up your nose. And I can't imagine having access to that every day. I mean, it might be beneficial for some who experience, you know, severe depression or anxiety, but that's something that we have to be mindful of because of alternative viewpoints or politically motivated people to get things outlawed. I think in the right dosage, under the right setting, it can be transformational for a lot of people.
Right. But I don't care about that. If I'm a political rhetorician, I'm just making hay with you. So all I got to do is find one kid that found your inhaler, you know, and sucked it up, you know, up a little bit and was like, oh, you know, now his brain's gone, and you lose. Like, ketamine as an industry loses.
And I would hope
what's going to happen.
Yeah, I hope we move past that as a society. We can go back and look at the devil's lettuce. And what's the famous documentary that targeted marijuana in the like 20s or something?
Yeah, what's it called? Not Eraserhead, but it's the same kind of visual. Reefer Madness.
Thank you. Yeah, I would hope we're past. I mean, there's always going to be fear appeals and you know, things of that nature. Do you know rhetoricians that work on heavy fear appeals? For
sure. Well, I know people that, you know, I wouldn't call them de facto formal rhetoricians, but they're persuaders. Clearly, I mean, the Bannons of the world, the Stephen Millers, you know, the whole stuff in Brazil a couple of weeks ago with them invading, you know, the national headquarters there, the political headquarters there, and it was all set up by the Americans, you know, because they're like, well, hey, it's easier here, let's keep playing out these techniques somewhere else. So there are always people going to work the nefarious, unethical rhetoric side, because there's value in it. They can get power through it, and it's going to happen in every industry. It's going to happen in every new approach. You're going to get shredded if you're not prepared. And the drugs are hard, because there's a, you know, 75-year history of demonizing drugs in this country.
I think, maybe it's the silly emotional side of me that feels that there's a change coming. I mean, when people experience it, and I think a lot of folks are tired of taking these pills that are not changing their lives. And so we'll see. I'm excited. I'm a proponent. I'm a cheerleader. So
yeah, but those pills make a lot of money for pharma.
They do. They do companies. Indeed.
So again, you have real enemies, rhetorical enemies. And are you preparing to fight those people, or are you just be like, it's a good feeling change coming to the world?
No, I'm going to choose to put the flower in the rifle, Dan. I'm just going to.
The ketamine in the soldier's mouth?
Yes.
You just walk around with your spray.
It'll start calming people down. Oh, man. I have no clue about ketamine until this trip. And I've been talking to a lot of friends who've had incredible experiences with it when they were using it recreationally. And they're like, oh my gosh, you can do that, you know, legally, therapeutically. I mean, I'm talking about friends who have used it and then like stop using drugs altogether, stop drinking out of just stumbling upon it. So there's something there. Definitely something there.
Yeah. Again, as a bloodless rhetorician, I don't care ultimately whether it's true or not. What I care is what side am I engaged on in order to try to get it into the world or keep it out of the world, you know?
Are you on the Chappelle camp of who pays you more, ketamine company or the anti-ketamine company?
I have ethics about who I, you know, what I do. Like my whole brand is ethical oriented persuasion.
What's the like one company where it's like, did you ever have one of those companies where you started consulting with and it was?
There was a company, yeah, that I worked with that I thought the guy running it, I don't think he was a scammer. But he was punching above his weight. He was trying to get a company started and he hadn't done, you know, a lot of the foundational work that he needed to do on the software where it would actually be viable. He knew what he wanted it to be, but he kept telling people he'd done a lot more than he had. And he was raising money and he was getting investors. And I was like, you're going to end up in jail because you're overclaiming what the product is. Like instead of saying, hey, here's the plan, because that's not a strong enough appeal for people to drop money on you. He just overclaimed to try to get, you know, more solidity in his pitch. And that's, you know, I backed away from that. Like I'm not helping you with that pitch. Like that's unethical persuasion. Dial it back to where it actually is. And if you can't win, then you need to do the work to get it elevated before you pitch it.
Yeah, I wonder if you would do consulting on legal work. Would you help construct arguments for legal defenses?
I think ketamine, if you're starting a business in that or wanting to, you know, get ketamine into the world, you need all that stuff. Like it needs to be pre-constructed. And I've done a lot of that work for like some ID companies that would... they work in the ID sort of security space, and they were making claims in their advertising that were beyond what they could actually deliver. And I'm like, yeah, you know what? That's illegal because you're overclaiming to sell and you're not going to be able to deliver that product. So I went through all their communication and found the things that were provable, kind of mixed, and then things that were unprovable that they should yank out of their communication.
Yeah, that's going to be hard with psychedelics. It'd be interesting. I'm fascinated on the industry as a whole and what will happen with their rhetoric and marketing as things become legal. The claims are going to be really fascinating to pay attention to.
Yeah, I think, again, sort of if you look at maybe the right way of doing this is create some national organization that does all the narcotics or psychedelics that are wanting to come online. And pay them to create a mass set of scripts for people to be able to do sophisticated rhetoric around it. Because just trying to do it in the moment yourself, you're going to fail at some point when you run against, you know, a real, you know, competitive rhetorician.
Yeah, you're going to need to be prepared for sure.
Yeah. Interesting. So, I used to be married to a therapist who, you know, pushed cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, which is kind of the, you know, luxury item in the therapy world.
Yeah.
And I saw it not work.
What were y'all's dinners like? I can't imagine a behavioral therapist with a rhetorician and stand-up comedian. That This must have made for some romantic dinners.
Oh, you have to check out the one person show, The Revenge of the Marriage Counselor's Ex-Husband. I'm not down on therapy, like, and I'm open to any therapeutic approach, any guru. I don't care. Like, I don't know whether it's true or not. What I care about is, like, you know, as a rhetorician, what are you claiming it can do? What does it actually do? And are those things meeting up? You know, if you're overclaiming, then you're in an unethical space, and that's a problem. You're selling something that you can't deliver.
Did you help her with her claims?
No. That was closer to the divorce. She was kind of touchy. And therapy has been fighting these things for a long time. Psychoanalysis and, you know, the whole discrediting of Freud. I love how everybody's like, oh, Freud was wrong. I'm like, did you know what Freud said in the first place? Did you?
I went to his house in London, or like right outside of London. That, could tell that he was into some weird things.
Well, he talked to, you know, completely broken people all the time. That was his whole thing.
It's true.
You hear a bunch of really weird theory, ideas and dreams and stuff, and suddenly you're like, you know, people are weird. But it's funny, you know, again, as a rhetorical structure, somebody like Freud, what has survived Freud? He wrote tons of books and incredibly complicated theory. And the things that have survived, like, you know, that he prescribed cocaine, back to your drugs. You know, cocaine
not,
was the,
damn, they're not my drugs. I gotta say, just for
Jonathan,
the audience,
me, I'm calling it
I don't have ketamine in my closet.
Alba. It's albumine. But it was the exact same rhetoric at the time. Like, cocaine elevates mood, it, you know, alleviates depression and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's fascinating about his work. I haven't dove too much into it. When I was in London, I was studying and researching C.S. Lewis as a master communicator. And there was a book published where Freud and Lewis would debate one another if they were alive today. And so that was the reason behind, like, looking into him and visiting his house. I don't even think I read that book in the class. It didn't really interest me. Two dead people in a hypothetical debate. Something didn't just, you know, grip me. But really fascinating. Yeah, I guess being in his house and seeing, like, the dimly lit, he had like a lot of velvet and these weird statues. Could just tell that he was a very interesting, deep thinker. And yeah, people have been prescribing drugs for a long time. I mean, our current medical system still prescribes drugs. They're just legal.
Constant. I mean, it's one of the massive de facto answers for, you know, struggling humans.
Could you imagine, though, being prescribed cocaine? Like, did that stick your prescription?
Well, back then, you know, cocaine was the beginning of Coca-Cola, right?
Sure.
So it wasn't an out there drug. The upper class white, you know, collar executives hadn't grabbed it yet and turned it into a party.
Yeah, that would be one heck of a prescription. I could say that, because,
well, think about it. You know, a lot of, like, sort of drugs and culture, right? If we're bringing those things together, you know, again, rhetorically, to decide how to make some changes or how we want it to be. So drugs and culture always have to be negotiated. So in the 80s, you know, you have the war on drugs. Well, suddenly you're using war metaphors and these incredibly violent metaphors and the cartels and the headless, you know, and all this stuff floods into drugs versus the 70s, where it's like, hey, you know, smoke pot, free love. It's totally benevolent drug.
So what will be the metaphor for us moving forward as a society that we want to choose with drugs? I mean, that's something, and agree with you, as a young, you know, rhetoric student full of energy and enthusiasm and passion to change things. You know, the war on drugs was something that, you know, we look into. The other one is immigration, which has, you know, been cycled throughout the years of using the parasite metaphor or degrading animalistic language. I'm curious, Ed, knowing that we have power over the language we choose, what will be the metaphor moving forward? And if folks will start to think about that so that we can shape a more insightful, thoughtful discussion versus what's been happening, yeah, for decades.
Well, again, this is to me like the rhetorical tradition of civility and intellectual debate and respecting everybody's opinion, but trying to get to the correct answer. It is a very difficult model in the social media, cable media world. Like, it just takes too much time. It's too slow. It requires education. It requires patience. It requires zenness towards the other side. And it just opens up, again, for nefarians to flood the plane and hack into it and just set off, you know, explosives and fires everywhere rhetorically and get all the attention.
Yeah,
that's literally what's happened in our politics.
Really fear-based and emotional. I mean, that's just hitting that what do we call it? System one thinking, that emotional side of the brain that just reacts. Yeah, it takes a lot of time to think through politics, religion, drugs. They're a lot more complicated than we make them sound.
Yeah, very complicated. And this is, I call it limbic persuasion. Like if you want to be when you start picking up skills in rhetoric and you start using them out in the world, it's a mega skill to be able to tap into somebody's limbic system. So fear, anger, hatred, surprise, any of the emotions that you cannot resist experiencing in intense formats, outrage is the best one. Disgust and repulsion. If you watch Fox News, it's almost all disgust and repulsion. You know, whenever they're talking about somebody, the other side, whoever target they're going after, watch their broadcasters. They're like literally snarling and like making, oh, how dare they, you know? But it's all limbic. It goes under into the limbic system instead of the, you know, advanced thinking.
It's been fascinating to be around a lot of like in a different industry and watch people in different situations and realize when they're in that state, and trying to get them back to a higher state, dealing with a lot of people in crisis and sometimes under the influence. And one of the questions that always comes out that I don't ask often enough in like sales interactions and whatnot, or like, what disgusts you? And just starting a conversation there can lead to some really fun, fascinating conversations.
Yeah, totally agree. I think, you know, staying on the ketamine thing and the drugs thing, your biggest asset persuasively is praxis. You're not going to persuade anybody until they experience this themselves. You might get a little bit from empathy of seeing changes in people that have had a hard time for a long time. So they get some empirical, anecdotal experience with improved people. You know, that might be a powerful way of doing it. But the real thing here is practice. Because if I had to talk to you about ketamine 2 months ago, you would have no feelings about it whatsoever.
Absolutely none. I would have told you to get the fuck out of my face and like, what are you talking about? And there's something also with me and my study and practice of persuasion that a lot of folks in my life will listen to me, have influence. And so there's practice, there's a praxis part, and there's also the social influence piece of it. When I talk about it, or my buddy who went through it, you can hear like the emotion in our voices when we talk about it. I think it hits that limbic part of the brain. But yeah, someone has to experience it, and I would imagine for a lot that can be fearful, not knowing what's going to happen, to like give up control in that sense, and you know, all the stories and the images we have about psychedelics, losing control of one's mind can be pretty scary.
Sure. Yeah, you have a strong dystopian strand in your product.
Well, that was what was wild for me. I learned through the experience that I can really trust my mind.
This time.
All three times. It was wild, Dan. Like on the third day, I was like, I was excited. You know, we packed up our stuff to go to the room where we would have our journeys. And I was like really freaking excited, like what was going to happen. Cause I knew that if anything negative came up, that I'd be able to handle it. And I've since learned that, you know, they have like, there was licensed professionals there, but in working in a therapeutic setting, they help you prepare for that. So there are ways to mitigate it. But yeah, it was so positive. And it was really cool to be like, my mind is my friend, despite, you know, it having some negative thoughts from time to time. So it's fun to explore it.
Yeah. Again, like you have a strong utopian rhetoric here.
Where's the dystopian? There's going to be a dystopian story.
You have a strong dystopian story. And as the rhetor of the moment who's trying to protect this, either as a business or as a social issue calling, you have to prepare for that. And you can't just out utopia dystopia. Like the one you just pulled up, people's fear of what's going to happen to their mind.
Yeah.
Like you're doing a neurological experiment on yourself. And you can say, we've got experience of how this works. We've got professionals, it's been studied, all that kind of stuff, which is logosing, you know, the world. But you're going to have to deal directly with that idea of what if this goes wrong and I restructure my neurology in a way that can't be recovered.
And I think that's, I mean, I don't know that that's happened, but, you know, small instances, and that's why there are screeners and, you know, do this with a licensed professional. Now I'm doing the rhetoric of safety. So yeah, they will have to prepare for that. And it has caused some serious issues for some people, folks have become addicted to ketamine. I'm sure people have had negative experiences, and won't go near it. So a quick Google search on Google Trends will bring up articles, which was fascinating afterwards too. Folks, you know, dying, being under the influence of ketamine and trying to drive. So there's a ton of you know, landmines, so to speak, that folks in the industry will have to navigate for sure.
Well, and again, I think that's the interesting thing about modern rhetoric is it doesn't matter how pure you are. It doesn't matter how good your product is. You put it out there and the internet allows people to get public messaging out about you, and anybody doesn't have to be rational, can be a competitor, makes no difference, can now post about you and get into the discussion, get the dystopian into the discussion, can stain your product. And that's going to happen to every single human being, every single product, every movement from now on through all eternity. Is that you are going to get stained in the modernity public discourse. So you have to set up for it. You know, do you want to spend all your time answering that stuff? Like all the people, if you have a restaurant, you get a bad review on Yelp. You see people lose their minds. I have a friend who has, you know, an Airbnb in Big Bear, and she had straight fives. And then one woman showed up and loved it, gave her all great feedback, and then gave her a four. And it ruined her rating. It brought it down to like 4.8 or something. And she's like, she literally texted or emailed the woman. It's like, why did you give me a four after you loved the place? And she's like, well, I was at a place before that was even better than yours, and I consider that a five. And so I didn't want to give you a five. And she's like, that doesn't make sense. Now you're having to instruct people how to rate you on Yelp in order to protect your business.
Or hide them. I mean, they've learned of a tool where, like, if you get a bad review, it'll email you and, like, won't go to your, I mean, it's wild what we're having to deal with, and think about and think through, which is another reason to go do ketamine therapy. So I have to stop worrying about that shit.
I don't want you to stop worrying because I'm a rhetorician and you're just leaving yourself vulnerable if you're too happy.
Of course. I mean, I was listening to some Andrew Huberman podcast, and he talks about that and how it can be enlightening to sometimes get in a debate in the comment section because they'll pick up things that he wasn't aware of. That's obviously a small percentage. A lot of the folks are there to troll him and, you know, try to bring him down. So it is a conscious choice of how much you want to engage in that. And most folks, as we know, are not trained in how to do it in a constructive, thoughtful way. So
or
it
in an
mudslinging really quickly.
You know, I don't care if it's constructive or thoughtful. That's just, again, a rhetoric. I don't care if you flame back at this person. I you know, like having good defenses set up is just really, it's good policy these days. In fact, you're being negligent if you're launching something and you haven't at least prepared the rhetorical environment. Like, just like you guys, like your ethos that you're talking about, you know, that you can clearly demonstrate authenticity of positive regard for this drug and a positive experience. And you can be very authentic about that. And that's your ethos right now. But, you know, all somebody's got to do is go in and just attack your credibility. What does he know about it? He's done it three times. He's not a professional doctor. He's just some guy who got his brain scrambled by ketamine.
Yeah. And I'd say you're exactly right. I don't know anything about it. and I've spent time in, you know, the world of psychology, communication. Yeah. I mean, I don't take my word for it. I just had a great experience and I'm happy.
You want people to take your word for it.
I don't, man. I literally do not want people to take my word for it.
You clearly do. You want to, like, you're talking about this kind of as a business, right? You're that interested in it?
Potentially. Talking about it, there's some challenges to doing so. So it would be something that I would like to share with the world at some point, whether it's just through my story or potentially starting a business. Still exploring that possibility.
That's one of the things I like about you, just generally as a person, is that typically things that interest you are a way of offering something to the wider community. You know, sometimes, you know, through you, through what you've learned, yoga training or this, or, you know, your rhetoric background, your work with small communities to try to get them, you know, up to speed on real business principles. Those are all good things to bring to the world. I mean, it's hard to criticize those, at least the impetus, you know, that's, to me, that's your, one of your core ethos elements that I like a lot.
Well, thank you, Dan. It's been really fun to try to figure these things out rhetorically, like how to create offers around, you know, yoga, meditation. Like one of my dreams is just to buy a bunch of billboards and put meditation on there because it's free and you can get it whenever you want. To public safety or economic development for small communities. It's not going to say it's been easy, but it feels good to try to offer things to help humanity move forward or someone, you know, better themselves emotionally, spiritually, or physically. So.
Yeah, there's never, it's never like, that's again, what's kind of become in the modern environment. There is no easy way to get messaging out. There's no easy way to get it to the people that you wanted to receive it. There's no easy way to persuade those people in a nice, clean manner. There's no way to protect yourself from the things that'll come at you. You have to, you can't just assume that stuff. You have to actively build it. And you know, even when you've talked about like nonviolent communication, which, you know, to me, I've seen a lot of these different things that have gone back. And basically, sometimes I think of it as like the arcade arm that goes back into the 70s Gestalt therapy.
Yes. Theory, I love Gestalt.
Picks it up and drops it over here with a new name. And now it's nonviolent communication. And I'm like, that's cool.
Well, it needs a new name. If you can help, Dan, it needs to be rebranded. Because it doesn't roll off the tongue, so to speak, and it attracts a very niche specific audience.
Yeah, well, and it's got the word violent in it. I mean, you know, even compassionate communication, or you know, that kind of stuff that does a utopian name instead of a non dystopian name.
And I think Marshall knew that. I think he's commented, Marshall Rosenberg, who created it and founded it. He's like, this is the best name I could come up with, and it's not great.
As a rhetorician / marketer, we talked about this last time we talked, that, you know, names are so important and people just push through with bad names because they run out of resources. They can't come up with it themselves. And instead of going to like a super namer, like comics or people that are really good at creating diamonds, linguistic diamonds, they can't find those people, or they can't afford them, or they don't know that they're there. And so they just push forward with a bad name. And I'm like, you've just crippled your entire, you know, like nonviolent communication is too strong a name that doesn't describe what it actually is.
Yeah. So with the expert namer and comedian, what name would you give nonviolent communication?
I would take it through my 6-week process and give you, you know, 40 different options. Oof. Boil it down to 10 and boil it down to 3. And then here's the one that works.
I think I'd like to do that rebrand. I mean, it's such a freaking cool language. I know we've talked about it. You know, several like it. I studied communication for many, many years and then stumbled upon this and was like, what the hell did I even study? Mainly because a lot of the communication that I looked at or practiced or taught left out emotion.
Yeah.
And emotion drives so much of human behavior. And so to have a language that can label and describe emotions feelings and then make a request to get like your needs. It was just mind blowing. And I've been able to share this with a ton of people, and it makes an immediate impact in their life. Not necessarily all the time in communicating with others, more so in understanding themselves and being able to have a less violent communication internally, which can lead to different outcomes when they try to communicate with other people. And I've been a violent communicator. So it's been a great journey in learning and practicing it.
I told you I was going to start extra violent communication. Because as a rhetorician, I don't care about, you know, brutality, precision over brutality, like, or brutality or precision. I don't care. To me, like, what I'm very agnostic about words. Ultimately, when I see people do soft communication, like take these words out, take this stuff out, to me, it diminishes the conversation. And being a working class guy who went through academics, I was way too brutal for grad school academics, like using the word fuck while you're, you know, talking about another student's, you know, paper or whatever, just like set off a bomb in the room. And I'm like, what are you getting so upset about? You know,
I love Kurt. Yeah, it's, I haven't figured out how to incorporate it into my like daily like life in a sense. Like there's a handful of people that I will practice nonviolent communication with. Like it's called street giraffe. So you have to learn how to like mold it and morph it so you can bring it out into the world and people don't look at you like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, I'm not trying to do therapy with you right now. Like, so like, what are you talking about? Like we had a client on the Code 4 side, we were on an event site and someone kept asking her from our team, like, what do you need? And she kept getting pissed, like, what, stop fucking asking me that. What are you talking about? And then I started to talk about how we've incorporated this into our company. And she like light bulb, it clicked. And she was like, I want that for our team. It's like a shortcut. But yeah, most people aren't ready or like willing to hear that. So it's a trick. It's called street giraffe, Dan. You got to learn the lingo.
Yeah. And you guys just lingo it differently. Like I call it interpersonalism. There's all sorts of techniques within interpersonal that have, again, been grabbed through Gestalt and redrafted into terminology that sort of fits whoever's, you know, the proponent of it. But it's super powerful. You know, I had to teach my son how to do validations as a, you know, interpersonal tool. Like I noticed he tends to argue before he validates. And nobody wants to say something that they believe or make a statement about something and immediately get blowback. It's no fun to talk to somebody like that. That's just countering everything that you say.
So what's an example of something that he would do?
Oh, anything. Like you could say, you know, I think strawberries are better when they're cut, you know, with the destemmed and, you know, cut and like that. And he'd be like, I like him with whatever, you know, he would just take the counter. And that's a very common conversational structure for people. But I would label it as a dysfunctional structure because it doesn't do the bridge, which earns you the right to counter. The bridge is, yeah, I can see why those are good. Like when you de-stem them, easier to eat, you know, appreciate all that work. And then you counter, but it's also like, sometimes I like them like this, using qualifiers, validations, things like that earns you the right to be negative. If you're just negative, then you're just no fun to talk to.
I hope you read like a parenting book one day, like rhetoric techniques for parents. I find it fascinating. Didn't you also, you taught your son how to in relationships too? I found that to be like really fascinating.
Yeah. We scripted out a breakup script for him. And the same thing, it's like, what do you focus on? People don't get these sort of hyper sophisticated communication training. And that to me is nonviolent communication. You guys are giving very clear tactics. Like Here's the phrases, here's when to use them, here's why you use them. And that's very useful to people.
Oh my gosh. Like I'm reminded every day that like folks have never read a book about communication, taken a class about it, or if they did have a class, who God knows who taught that class, some graduate student who, anyway. And having a framework, my favorite, Dan, are engineers, because I can put nonviolent communication into a formula. Mm-hmm. And so if they can just use that formula, they can save themselves a lot of pain, discomfort, and or communication outcomes. So sometimes it's just the best we can do with some folks.
Well, I think all those interpersonal techniques, if you look at the list, and there's a huge list of them, and you're like, oh, I don't validate people. That's a dysfunction. It's a mechanical dysfunction. It's not you're a bad person. You're just argumentative and you don't care. And you're a, contradictor. My father was a contradictor, but that he'd just been trained into that. It wasn't a psychological expression of his soul.
Yeah. Well, that's a core premise of nonviolent communication, is making evaluative statements. And we judge people that, Dan is angry or Dan is evil. Like, what does that mean? What are the behavioral characteristics that you're displaying that would indicate that you are this thing? That's one of my favorite things about nonviolent communication that I learned, is I make a lot of evaluative statements. They can be very harmful and violent.
We got to get rid of the term violent, because it's overreaching. It's not a violent thing to evaluate others. It may be a jarring thing. It may be dysfunctional. I use functional and dysfunctional all the time.
I like that. You taught me that functional, dysfunctional. It's very good. Thank you for I was like, where did that frame go? Functional, dysfunctional. It's really good.
Yeah. Cause it has there is no emotional attachment to function and dysfunction. Some people will be like, I'm being dysfunctional. I'm like, yeah, but you can fix it. That's the whole thing about functionality. Like, it's not that hard to fix. And my son picked up those two things, how to break up with somebody and how to validate. I had to teach him how to validate for his, because his sister, I had to teach it to her too, but they would always argue. And I'm like, you're just attacking each other with counters, and that's not pleasant. So somebody's going to get mad. But if you counter with validation and then your opposition, then everybody like, I get it. You complimented me first.
Well, the other one too with your kids was how you punish them. I found that to be, what didn't you threaten to put your daughter, you had some philosophy with punishment about putting someone on the roof.
I never told my kids no, and I never punished them with negativity. I punished them with positivity. So like jokes, creativity, like doing something to them that they would remember, but wasn't a punishment. So I would threaten to, like, my son would do something. It's like, I'm going to put you on the roof. And he's like, what are you talking about? I'm like, that's what kids, when I was growing up, that's what parents did with kids. The moms would put the kids on the roof if they'd been bad. And when the dads drove in that night, they could look up and see all the kids that have been bad. They will remember that forever.
That's great.
Because it's creative feedback that still gets the point across, but it's not negative.
Again, parenting advice, Dan French.
From Rhetorician.
Yes, that's a bestseller right there.
Yeah, and I've got that laid out too. Like, I've got this stuff sort of organized now, where I've done enough of the intellectual work that now translating into basic communication and then some kind of flavored communication and figuring out what medium to put it into. That's kind of been the project about moving back here to California. I've had a lot of free time. I've had a lot of time to work on all these different projects. That's why things like The Blast, getting interesting people on to talk about current events or ketamine or whatever, I think is a really interesting podcast. And when I listen to somebody like Joe Rogan, I get it. He's exploring a lot of the same things. I just don't think he goes deep enough. And I think he gets, swayed into some bad, unethical belief land because he's not really, he's not a dissector. He's not a rhetorician. He's not a trained intellectual. And I want that to be a positive thing for people again. Hey, let's listen to these intellectuals because it's so much fun. They found such great ideas. Not, oh, these intellectuals, that's boring.
So who's your top intellectual that you want to have?
Oh my God. I used to love to listen to Chomsky. Mm. That guy was so precise and so, good at just taking these massive concepts and just using them so fluidly, just amazing. And there's a bunch of guys like that down through time, Kenneth Burke, seeing his writings and stuff. He was so entertaining the way he wrote. And I couldn't get through a paragraph without stopping five times because there was a new idea.
Yeah, he was pretty extraordinary. And no one knows, barely anyone knows like who he is or who he was.
Yeah, there's a Harry Chapin. you know, Harry Chapin, the singer-songwriter, Cats in the Cradle.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah. There's a documentary about him. And just all of a sudden, in the middle of this documentary, Kenneth Burke shows up. And you're like, what's Kenneth Burke doing in a Harry Chapin, this massive philosopher, like the rhetorical philosopher, you know, language philosopher. He was his grandfather. That Kenneth Burke was Harry Chapin's grandfather.
Wow.
And so they have video of him. And like, there's one guy, one of the uncles is talking about him. He's like, yeah, Kenneth or Kenny, whatever they called him, you know, is the smartest guy in America. Nobody knows who he is. So it's crazy.
How much Kenneth Burke did you get into?
Oh, my, when, I read your studies. I read all of it.
All of it?
My master's and thesis, my master's thesis and dissertation director was the same guy, David Payne, massive Kenneth Burke academic.
So I hope my rhetoric professor doesn't listen to this, because she was a Burkean scholar. She went and studied at Purdue, which is like one of like the 20 places he got like an honorary PhD. For the lay people and myself, will you give an overview of Kenneth Burke?
Well, good luck. To me, like, Kenneth Burke's main thing is the ability to go into existing concepts and split them apart. So I sometimes the anecdote he uses about if a grasshopper could suddenly speak, what would it say? And this is the way he starts one of his chapters, maybe starts the book. And people are like, I don't know. It's like, it would say, tell me everything you know about birds that eat grasshoppers. What is the most important thing? What's the motive? You know, maybe that's in grammar of motives or rhetoric of motives.
Yeah. I don't
remember. It's been too long since I did academics. What is the main thing that the target you're talking to wants? They have to get from you. And just knowing that, like being able to split motives and understanding people's interest and what they're actually after is the core of rhetoric. So like right now, the ketamine stuff, I listen to you and I'm like, well, why is Jonathan so into ketamine? He had a good experience with it. He had a narcotic wandering around his brain. He's got some elation. He's got some good effects of it. True or not, I don't know. I don't care. But he's gotten a good experience and he'd like to share that with people.
Yeah, so it always comes back to what's my motive or what's their motive, to put it into the practical everyday usage of like, what would you do with Kenneth Burke besides read, you know, thousands of pages? It can be distilled down. That's why I love rhetoric so much. So tactical and practical, into any conversation that someone enters is like, what's my motive and what do they need to hear from me?
Yeah, and that kind of stuff that you come out with, if you don't stay in academics and practice it all the time, it just, you know, all that great fluff starts to fade in the background, but you keep these gems. And to me, like what I've done a lot with businesses over the last 7 years is bring the gems. Like, I don't care what you want in your messaging when I come to work for you as a business. I don't care. I don't even want to hear it, your aesthetics and your choices as a business owner. Only thing I care about is who you're trying to sell to and what do they need to hear? Like, that's what I'm trying to figure out. Like when we did your stuff with Code 4, I'm like, ultimately, I think, you know, you've got this little pile of gemstones, the idea of you guys being like this amazing partner that anybody can partner with around the world, to me was like a pretty strong offer. And so you pick one of those and you build your messaging around it to try to convince the world that that is true and that they can find a great partnership or whatever. But that's Burkean. You know, what do they need to hear in order for me to succeed?
And it was so difficult. Ethical. Yeah. And going through that process, because really it's a commitment to focus on one message. And I mean, just being in business, having multiple service lines, that was a huge, huge undertaking and challenge. And so when I hear you say it, it sounds so simple. Like I could like write on a note card now, but being in the thick of it is, it feels overwhelming. And I mean, you have a really unique and a knack for getting to the core of always bringing it back to, yeah, who you're trying to reach, who you're trying to sell to, and what do they need to hear. It's like a mantra. People can just repeat that in the business world.
Well, yeah, as a rhetorician, I think all your, that's why I say all your messaging should be built from the outside. You should not build your own messaging. Now you can contribute to it. Like I harvest from people and they say great things and stuff like that, but you need an outside message expert constructor to come in and look at everything and feel, and then start to extract, because you can't do it yourself.
Well, and how do you, I mean, you dealt with this with us and, you know, not having clear traction.
Go ahead.
You're not having clear traction, meaning we're in the midst of trying to pivot and find, you know, what's the new niche after the pandemic, and really not being able to focus on a single thing. So what's your strategy to get folks to focus?
You mean to get them to focus, or is my strategy on what they should focus on?
Well, I mean, get them to focus on a core service offering, because there's the ability to, a business can offer many, 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 many things. And if it, you know, does many, many, many things, it usually does many, many things poorly.
You know, that's, everybody says that, but that's true. And it's not true. It doesn't matter whether you do, say you do 15 things and five of them you do, and five of them you do pretty good. And then five, you excel. It doesn't really matter to you as a business. Like maybe you're pulling less money from some of these. The answer to that question is always, it's always business decisions that drive your communication decisions. Where are you making your most money? Not what you enjoy doing the most. Where do you make your most money?
That's what founders struggle with. That's literally what founder, at least within my experience, what I've found is they have a pet project.
Yeah.
That is, if it's feeds the ego or what it feels good, looks good, and it's not making any money. And you've got this thing over here that's, you know, driving revenue, but it's not as fun.
Right. And that's again why you should have a separation in all these things, like the founder and the visionary and all this stuff. They're great. And in Hollywood, that's the core creative team, the conceptual team. Somebody has an idea for a movie. Everybody's like, that's a cool idea. And a lot of times at that point, they just take it from them, buy it. It's like, now we're going to have mechanics actually build this, because you're not a mechanic. You've never built a film. You've never built the show. You don't know how movie stories work. But you've got a great idea. Like Highlander is a great example of this. The movie Highlander was written at UCLA in an extension course. And the professor recognized this is a great story and took it to the producer or a production company, and they liked it. They bought it and basically ditched the guy who came up with it and brought in two hardcore pro screenwriters who developed it into what it is. So the creative genius, the inspiration, you need that mind, you need that emotion and that person, but they're not the person to do the mechanical construction of something, because that's not what their brains do. It kills them to try to do that stuff.
I've learned that lesson over the last 2 years.
So you split the jobs, and that's the genius of Hollywood, is it splits jobs. Like they'll literally do step deals on films in Hollywood. It's like, we have six different rough drafts or drafts, and the first writer gets the first shot. And then if we don't like it, fired new writer, like it. Nah, I think as far as they can go, fired new writer, because they know that on a movie does so much that almost nobody has a gas tank that can do all the things a movie has to do. But they've figured these things out and then come up with mechanical solutions for message construction.
You got to talk more about this. I mean, it's fascinating. Even how like writing rooms are set up and that process, I think businesses or organizations, nonprofits, whatever, can learn so much from the Hollywood machine, because it works. It continues to churn out result after result after result.
Yeah. I've always, the two models I come crashing into business with are rhetoric, you know, and Hollywood. And it's like, you know, you guys, these are both message expertise areas. That's what they do. Businesses are not message expert companies. They're businesses.
So I'm wondering, like, how can businesses act more like writing rooms? Like, how can we incorporate some of that creativity and kind of energy in the day-to-day runnings of the function, whether it be in meetings or just normal?
You literally bring somebody in to executive produce. That's the first thing. There's always an executive producer in Hollywood, and they hire everybody and they fire everybody when they get something wrong, because that's Hollywood can't slow down. So you have to have somebody who's ultimately aware of everybody and what they're doing. And there's people ready to jump in and replace you in an hour. I can get a new writer in here.
Wow. You know?
And that's again, one of the geniuses of Hollywood is the way it does labor supply is insane. Like there's 500 people that are good at this job, dude. You know, be on your game. And so using some of those structures, because those have literally grown up as solutions to problems. It's like, we have five writers, two of them aren't very good. We're on, 13-week contracts, they're fired, bringing the two new writers. And everybody knows that's the way it works. Businesses don't have pipeline structures like that. They're not a hardened pipeline structure. So adopting some of that would be super helpful in businesses. And that's kind of what I've done, you know, again, when I try to come in and consult, you can't tell businesses to adapt and start doing this because they can't do it. But you can say, hand it over here. I will start taking through this process and keep you involved so you can see what's happening. But all I need for you is like dailies. Like I'm going to show you the options. You point the one you like, and we're going to keep going in that direction.
Maybe. You bring a lot of organizational design skills as well as the creativity and the writing and the rhetoric, just because of the structures that you describe that you've been in. I remember talking to you and you could really easily pick up, communicate about, and give recommendations for structure decisions or the way things are flowing within an organization. So it's really fascinating, the multifaceted skill set that you bring and viewpoint.
Well, it makes things easier on everybody. You know, it's so hard to build good messaging. And I feel sorry for executives. They're not message people. And suddenly they're in there having to make decisions. Like you show them options. Like, I don't know.
Dan, it's so true. I mean, I'm trained in this. And now being in an executive function, it's like I forgot it all. The level of complexity, the amount of decision. Yeah, it's overwhelming at times.
Yeah. Well, you're not in the executive producer role. You're trying to do executive producer stuff, but that's not your job. Your job is running the business and trying to do sales, and you're doing all these other things. Executive producer just sits on top of it like a rooster on top of the whole hen house. It's like, where is everything? I heard something over there. I don't like it. You know, and if you don't have somebody doing that aware of the project, it's going to sprawl and it's going to break down, and then you can't build good messages. So yeah, a lot of this stuff's really useful, which, you know, I enjoy finding that niche of bringing these things into it and saying, hey, these things have already been worked out somewhere else. Let's harvest from there and I can fix your problem with structure. Hmm. Yeah. Let's bring in like if you want a name for nonviolent communication, like you asked me, well, you're creative. I'm like, yeah, I also know how hard it is. So like, here's a 6-week process. Got to go through it. Do not try to go around the pipeline because you won't get what you want.
It works every time. But yeah,
it does work every time because the structure won't let it not work. If it's not working, you bring in new people within the structure to make sure it now works.
Yeah, not continuously try to change the structure, which tends to happen quite a bit in business.
Well, businesses don't have a structure. They're improvising their way through. And, you know, they're using standard practices or they're using meetings and brainstorming and things like that. And those are very, insufficient structures. They're going to force you to fail. And that's what I always get frustrated with. You see, we've talked about this so much. Like, I don't get frustrated with it anymore, but I look at it and go, I can't get involved in that. Hand it back here. Let me structure it and keep it clean so everybody can benefit from their work instead of working against each other. And if you can get people into that mode, they're like, oh, yeah, you do it. I would love for somebody else to do this.
Well, what comes up for me when you were like, from all that you've learned and that you bring, what was your favorite writing room that you're in or show that you're on where you learned the most?
My favorite writing room was the Late Late Show, because the structure, and I liked most of the writers It's a really talented writing staff. Dennis Miller was maybe even a more talented writing staff, but we didn't spend much time together. We would walk in the morning, and I had an office mate, Matt Pearl, who was a really good writer from New York. And we would just have assignments next to the computers. And you sit down and like, here's the 40 stories from the day of the news, and just pick the ones you like and just start writing jokes. And you're basically done in 2 hours. And then they collated all of it. And we kind of group meet, but the executive producer was a really good writer, Eddie Feldman. So he would just, him and Dennis was a really good writer. He knew what was funny. They would pick the jokes they liked, and then we'd rehearse them, throw out the ones that didn't work, keep the ones that did, and you were done. So it was very efficient, and they were all really good writers, but I didn't get to spend much time working with them. The Late Late Show, we would meet for an hour every morning all together, and have bagels and coffee and listen to the craziness of everybody's lives. That was more fun.
It is the communal experience that makes the greatest impact.
Sometimes, as long as you have a functional writer's room. There were a couple of, after I left there, I had a friend who stayed there, and he's like, oh yeah, it's changed. They you know, got a new head writer, and they got a couple of dysfunctional writers in the room. So, you know, there was aggressiveness about the creativity, and people would take shots at each other and stuff like that. And yeah, I don't want to work in that environment because I'm too good at taking shots at people. I'm like, that's not going to work out.
We've talked about this. Yes, the blessing and the curse.
I love building on what everybody else is doing and appreciating what they're doing. And to me, that's a really great writer's room. But it's hard to manage because people, you know, you'll pitch something and somebody won't like it. And if they go sour on it verbally, you're like, now you've got conflict. You know, I've seen really good head writers be like, yeah, I can see why that would work. Let's see what else we can get. So that you're not crushing it, and everybody learns to have thick skin. But yeah, if somebody just jumps on my joke and takes a shot at it, I got a buddy who's a really good writer. We talk every once in a while, but he jumps on jokes with golf shoes. And I'm like, dude, don't go after my joke.
Yeah, the yes and, Dan, yes and.
Yeah, beautiful energy, right? Yes and.
It is. That was the biggest lesson from improv and doing some improv training. You can like feel the energy when someone, I think it's called like zapping, or, you know, brings in a no. It's a really powerful exercise to experience that like physically.
Yeah, no, that's one of those gem concepts that emerges from improv. Improv has a lot of stuff that's really useful. I hate it, but
I freaking love it. I wouldn't like do the skit writing. I like the games. That was one of the most fun things I did last year, was improv training, because of just being on your feet, having to think, and not shutting people down. I started to realize like it's like a default for most people, and you get to see people work through their own shit. You're like, whoa, this person probably like, that's how she talks to her husband. Like, oh, like she just goes to anger every time. It's fascinating.
No, I love a lot of that stuff. And I really do appreciate improv for what it is. The reason that I hate it is that as a professional comedy writer and a professional entertainer, it's more about efficiency and economy and getting to something fast with the least amount of energy. And there are too many people in improv that are there that aren't naturally talented as comedy writers or comedians. They're enjoying it. And yeah. Again, I totally appreciate it, and those things are valuable. But for me, I'm there trying to, like, I'm meeting with a buddy of mine tonight to work on our stand-up, because he's trying to get back into stand-up and do cruise ships, and I'm doing cruise ships. And my first cruise ship was horrific. I hadn't done stand-up in 8 years. And suddenly... Yeah,
Dan, I'm surprised that you're going back out on the uncharted waters.
Well... It was bad because of very specific things. Like, the venue was bad. The audience was a bunch of Brits. They were bad. And I was bad. I didn't know what to expect. My show was rusty, yada, yada, yada. So I wouldn't go back under those circumstances. But the next one is an American audience, much better venue. I'm ready to go. But I'm working tonight with another pro comic, going back and forth on our script to let him start adding some juice, because I've kind of, you know, squeeze the orange as much as I can, but he'll have different perspectives. But having a pro that you're improvising with is so much better than having amateurs.
Very, very different. Yes. I mean, completely agree. It was tough working with some folks in my improv class. And that's just level one. I can't imagine what your experience would be. And it's fascinating to see who people can like naturally pick it up.
Yeah.
And they have this energy about them that is so dynamic and attractive. And I would encourage people to go do a freaking improv class, regardless of what level you're at. And not listening to Dan over here criticize the
I'm not level again, one. I'm not, I totally that's me. Love see, improv.
That's me with the zop. See how it feels? It doesn't feel good.
I agree with that statement. Totally. But again, there's me as a professional and there's me as like, you know, a human being. I think human being, it's great training professionally. People who are great at improv are fucking amazing. I would sit there and listen to them all day long. They're so creative, the stuff they come up with, the characters, the voices, the scenes, yeah. Everything.
Being in, I went to Second City in Chicago, and that was a very unique experience. I also went to Second City in Toronto, and that was a very different experience. And you're exactly right. When someone can crush improv, it's super, super impressive because it's freaking hard to write a skit that kills. There is a lot of awkward pauses, silence when I was in Toronto.
Yeah, no, I love comedy at the highest level. I have a real hard time of comedy, professional comedy that's in the mediocre range. And then amateur comedy, I have a totally different mode for it. I'm like, I'm not here to criticize. Learn as much as you can. Have as much fun as you can. It's all good. You know, but I have those modes. Like, I love talent and I love working with talent. And I'll do it anytime because it's just so, you know, so at the core of what human beings can do. You're like, oh my God, this energy in this person and the peppery creativity, where's it going? And then all the mid-paint people are just sort of taking up space and shouldn't be there. You know, they're acting like comedians. And then, you know, regular humans.
Well, that was the biggest lesson for me with improv is to stop trying. The more I tried to be funny, the less funny I was. And I got that at the end. So I don't want to go do it again and try something different. Difficult lesson to take in because I thought I'm there to be funny. It's a really eye-opening, shocking moment for me when I discover what it like truly means to be funny.
Well, it's like acting. It's the same thing. When people try to act, they can't act. The first thing you learn in acting is quit acting. You know, just be. You know, be in the moment, respond, and then, you know, you'll be fine. But it's
so
a hard
deep
lesson.
And profound, Dan. So deep.
that's the first thing they teach in acting classes. Like, I need you to stop thinking. Yeah. Well, cool, man. This has been super fun.
Yeah.
We were on the blast.
Well, we blasted off, that's for sure.
It was a little more of a Rhetoric Warriors than a blast. It wasn't, we didn't do any current events or stuff. Maybe we'll circle back around and do a full blast at some point.
That's good. I've just been reading Barron's, so all I can talk about is financial news. So I'll brush up on my New York Times and
I take you through it. Like the stories where Andy Murray at the Australian Open was upset because they didn't let him go pee.
Mm.
You know, in a 4-hour match. David Crosby's dead. Alex Baldwin's charged with murder, manslaughter.
Saw that.
Trump has to pay $1 million to Hillary Clinton for her legal fees. Supreme Court leak. They can't figure out who leaked, but they didn't interview any of the justices, which I thought was hilarious.
What an interesting strategy. Yeah, I would have.
They're beyond it. They're above it.
Of course they are. The High Court, the Supreme Court, Dan. Yeah. Let me know if you want to go through the financial news. You know, I can do Elon, tech layoffs, crypto.
Yeah, same stuff. You could do. When I was at Dennis Miller, it was on CNBC, so it was financial stuff all day long, and then we would be the nighttime entertainment, and some of that stuff would leak in, so we would write financial jokes every once in a while.
That seems fun.
Yeah, there's always angles. Well, cool, man. Appreciate it. Super fun. We will come back around. You want anybody to go anywhere and check out your stuff anywhere?
You can check out what we're doing. Code 4, keeping people safe at events. Event season's coming up, so be safe out there. And if you want to reach out, have a conversation about yoga, ketamine therapy, nonviolent communication, or anything interesting that you're doing in the business world that's making our world a better place, reach out on LinkedIn.
Good pitch.
Thank you.
Well pitched. I like it.
I've worked with someone in rhetoric for a while. So
yeah, look at that. The guy's got skills. All right. It's been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there, learn some things, persuade people. They always need it.